The following episode of Lyrics of Their Life podcast deals with serious issues such as drug references, sexual references, and violence that may be distressing to some listeners. It is not suitable for children. Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome back to Lyrics of Their Life, the podcast where we explore the extraordinary lives lived by those that wrote or perform the songs we know and love. I'm your host Adam Hampton, and in today's episode, we jump back into the story of the weird and the wacky Tiny Tim, as we take off right after Tiny Tim and Miss Vicky tied the knot on national TV, only for their honeymoon period to be over rather abruptly. In this episode, we delve into the breakdown of Tiny Tim and Miss Vicky's relationship after their historic TV wedding, as Tiny also loses a child and becomes a father for the very first time, while we also watch Tiny's demise in the spotlight as he fights to remain relevant with the most outlandish publicity stunts that you've ever seen. All this and more in this shocking episode. This is The Story of Tiny Tim, Part 3. This is Lyrics of Their Life.
Prince has died at the age of 57.
This is it.
Sorry, Gary, but I was always the talented member of the band.
Keep booing, little girl. I will hit a man with glasses.
I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
Former Beatle John Lennon, who was 40, was shot and killed last night outside his luxury apartment in New York.
Has-beens shouldn't present fucking awards to gonna be.
Leave Britney alone!
During December 1969, Tiny Tim would be joined by an all-female rock and roll backing band called the Enchanted Forest, as they claimed that Tiny was difficult to work with. However, Vicky befriended the four girls from the backing band, claiming they were a saving grace in a way, as she felt like running from her marriage with Tiny, and she felt very isolated from her family, and she felt she could lean on the girls for support. Unfortunately for Vicky, it wouldn't get easier from here, with both Tiny and Vicky doubting their love for one another. While Tiny would often put Vicky down, talk down to her like she was a child, and claim that she acted childish, often overlooking the fact that she was 20 years younger than him, while Tiny also doubted Vicky's faith to God. In one crazy instance, Tiny even purchased a heap of pornographic magazines just to show Vicky the evils of the world, or so he claims. But despite treating Vicky so poorly at the time, Tiny continued to write positively in his diary about her, perhaps hiding the true flaws of their marriage. What embarrassed Miss Vicky most of all, however, was the fact that Tiny Tim practically forced her to perform on the Ed Sullivan Show during January 1971, after Ed had brought up the possibility of a duet between the two on an episode of his talk show. Vicky, of course, being the quiet and shy person that she was, and in no way a performer, initially refused, only for Tiny to guilt Vicky into agreeing, using the excuse that she would be letting down millions of people around the world if she said no. During rehearsals, Tiny often put Vicky down, telling her she looked terrible and couldn't sing, and when she threatened to quit, Tiny cunningly told her he would just replace her with another beautiful female singer and sing the intimate song to her instead, which of course did exactly what he thought it would do, making his wife jealous, as Vicky chose to suck it up and keep trying. During the 3.5 minute performance on the Ed Sullivan Show, Tiny and Vicky would sing a medley of songs, including a cover of The Turtles' Happy Together, as well as a number of other love songs, as Vicky could be seen wearing a wedding dress. And despite Tiny's lack of faith in her, she did quite well, considering she wasn't a trained singer. After the wedding on the Johnny Carson Show, followed by the popular duet on the Ed Sullivan Show, Tiny was back on top, and the world loved him again, as he would soon tour Australia, only to be surrounded by adoring fans when he first arrived. Tiny's popularity at this time meant he was now demanding almost $10,000 a night to be booked for gigs, and even opened at the Troubadour in January 1970. However, this didn't mean that Tiny had much spare cash to spend, despite splurging on things like room service, as he often threw tantrums aimed at his management, trashing hotel rooms, and throwing things about when he was told, "No, we can't afford that." Soon after this gig, Vicky began to experience morning sickness, with a trip to the doctor during February 1970 confirming Vicky was in fact pregnant to Tiny Tim. Tiny, being unable to control his excitement, would announce Vicky was pregnant while touring Australia, and in true Tiny Tim style, he hinted in interviews that he had been suggesting strange brand names for the baby, like V8 and Crest. During 1970, an idea was floated by Tiny's manager, Ron de Blasio, to Warner Brothers for Tiny to have his very own children's TV show, as his largest fan base at this time was children. However, this idea was scrapped after Tiny failed to turn up for a trial where he was set to be evaluated on his interactions with children to see if he suited the role. Tiny's failure to show up to the trial, along with Tiny failing to appear for an event called Festival of the Flowers, and his poor treatment of his managers over the years, would prove the final straw for de Blasio and Jeff Wald, who both decided to quit as Tiny's managers. As Tiny continued to tour with Miss Vicky by his side around the US, on May 15th, 1970, in Houston, Texas, after experiencing severe abdominal pain, Miss Vicky was seen by a hotel doctor from the hotel they were staying in, only to be told initially that she had just had a bad case of indigestion. However, once the doctor left, Vicky just knew something wasn't right when the pains persisted, as she insisted to Tiny that she be taken to the hospital. It was here where tests were run, and it was discovered that Vicky had sadly experienced a miscarriage, losing what would have been their first child together, and a baby boy, with the cause of the miscarriage being most likely due to stress. Tiny would blame himself for taking Vicky with him on tour while she was heavily pregnant. Despite the media in the past joking about Miss Vicky's pregnancy, claiming that perhaps the next step for Tiny was a live birth on The Tonight Show, this time around, the media chose to respect Tiny and Miss Vicky's wishes at this sensitive time and laid low on the news. Tiny and Vicky were both obviously devastated by the news, with Tiny declaring, quote, "Baby, I pray may he rest in peace." Tiny chose to have a proper ceremony for the baby, laying him to rest in a $250 casket in the Memorial Oaks Cemetery in Houston, Texas. However, what was most triggering and unbelievable was Tiny choosing a headstone that read the name It as his son's name. with Miss Vicky remaining in hospital and still grieving their loss. Tiny seemed less fazed by the tragic loss, or so it seemed, and travelled to New York to appear on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Despite Vicky pleading for Tiny to stay by her side, with Vicky claiming that Tiny said to her, quote, "business is business," before leaving Vicky with his assistant for a week in an unfamiliar town. Just 4 days after the miscarriage, Tiny also attended a recording studio in New York City to record Don't Bite the Hand That's Feeding You, before appearing 3 days straight on The David Frost Show as a guest host, doing almost anything other than being by his wife's side. Perhaps in his own way, this was his way of coping from the grief of their loss. However, Vicky needed him in such a sensitive time. Making matters worse was Tiny's financial situation at the time, as he owed countless people money, including band members, lawyers, and managers, and he was also being taken to court in multiple cases, with the biggest of these cases being against his former manager, George King, who was seeking $1.5 million in damages. Instead of facing his debts, a panicked Tiny decided to put himself further into debt, spending over $1,200 on makeup and cosmetics, as well as an 8-track player. In order to start paying his debts back, and in preparation for his impending lawsuits, Tiny toured relentlessly every day and night, with Vicky by his side once again at every gig, as he worked so hard to earn his paycheck that he lost his voice during one of the gigs, forcing him to cancel a show in Kentucky. During July 1970, Tiny released the song Don't Bite the Hand That's Feeding You with a B-side of What Kind of American Are You? However, the lead single wasn't as successful as it was predicted to be, and in fact flopped. Around the same time, on talk shows, Tiny made it known that he was supportive of America's place in the Vietnam War, which created a sense of controversy around him, as he claimed that Richard Nixon was wrong for pulling Americans out early. Meanwhile, a kid's board game focused around Tiny Tim was released to the public, called Beautiful Things, only to also be a commercial failure. In more positive news for Tiny, he would perform on the fourth day of the huge Isle of Wight Festival in Afton Down in England on August 29th, 1970, alongside mega acts like Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Miles Davis, and The Doors, just to name a few. Tiny was criticised for being booked alongside such big acts, as he didn't really fit the bill for the rock and roll festival. However, Tiny would create an incredibly memorable moment when he sung into a megaphone with his quirky old-fashioned style voice, as he sung There Will Always Be an England in front of around 500,000 people, with the Sunday Times reporting that Tiny Tim stole the show.
There'll always be an England while there's a country lane. Wherever there's a cottage small beside a field of grain, there'll always be an England while there's a busy street.
It was around the time of the Isle Wight Festival that Tiny and Miss Vicky also discovered that Vicky was pregnant once again, and had been for a number of months already. This excited the couple, but they chose to keep the announcement quiet until much closer to the birth. And despite Tiny's guilt over the previous miscarriage, Tiny kept Vicky on the road with him while they toured. While on their one-year wedding anniversary in Florida, Tiny would be set to perform a number of gigs, only to rush back home to New York to be by his 79-year-old father Boutros's side, who had been suffering from severe diabetes and previously had to get both of his legs amputated. Admitted for further complications in regards to his diabetes, Boutros's health was extremely poor and time appeared to be running out for him, as both Tiny and Boutros cried together when they were reunited. Around this time, while in Australia, Tiny even appeared in his very own special, featuring 49 minutes of songs and quirky performances.
Australia, come, rejoice, for we are young and free. We've golden soil and wealth, and toil our homes, our girth I see. Our land abounds with nature's gift.
Thank you. Oh, how wonderful you all are. How what a thrill it's been to be here tonight on this special with you. And well, until we meet again, this is Tiny Tim saying to all of my dear friends, wherever you are in TV land, good night.
Then on New Year's Eve, 1970, Tiny, along with Miss Vicky, would release their duet single titled Why, with the Spaceship song as the B-side, which would ultimately become his last recorded song under Reprise Records, as Tiny's deal was set to expire later in 1971. In the new year, on the 21st of February 1971, Tiny Tim would appear with Miss Vicky on The Ed Sullivan Show for what would be the final time during his career, as Vicky could be seen in what can only be described as a hideous huge white dress in order to hide Vicky's pregnant belly, as well as a large white hat that appeared far too big for Vicky's head, as together they sung the song Why. In the rehearsals for the performance, Tiny was believed to have caused an argument backstage when Vicky once again started to get stage fright and claimed that she didn't want to do it, only for Tiny to tell her how ungrateful she was being. As the rehearsals continued, Tiny actually became more supportive for once, as together they shared a laugh about Vicky's ridiculous outfit, and then right before they went onto stage, Vicky had an anxiety attack and threatened to pull out again, only for Tiny to hold her hand and tell her it was okay, as they would do it together. Trusting his word, they ventured out and performed what appeared like an awkward rendition of Why. Despite extensively touring and promoting Why, it failed to take off, as the now 38-year-old Tiny Tim feared once again that his career was on yet another downward trajectory, with crowd numbers significantly reducing at his gigs. Making matters worse was Vicky had begun to have serious anxiety attacks over the impending birth of their child, now 8 months into her pregnancy, and the media had started referring to Tiny Tim's weight, as he had been binging on Coca-Cola, ginger snaps, grapefruit, honey, and animal crackers, and had become noticeably overweight. Then, as the due date approached, sad news would eventuate when Tiny's father Boutros passed away on the 2nd of April 1971 at the age of 80. This crushed Tiny and Vicky too, who thought a lot of Boutros, as Boutros had hoped to hang on just a little bit longer so he could meet his grandchild. Just a month out from the birth of their child, Vicky stopped touring with Tiny in preparation for the birth. While Tiny was on tour and Vicky remained home, she started to go into premature labour and had to be hurried to the doctor's hospital in Manhattan, being driven there by a taxi cab all on her own. At 4 a.m, May 8, 1971, Vicky gave birth to a healthy baby girl, taking just 28 minutes during labour, with Tiny arriving the following day, as photos were taken of Tiny in awe of his daughter as he viewed her from behind the observation window. As he said, quote, "She's beautiful, and my, she's got a lot of hair. Thanks as Miss Vicky and the blessed event are doing fine." Initially, it took some time for their daughter to be named, with some insensitive journalists claiming that the baby should be named Victim. Eventually, Tiny and Vicky would name their daughter Tulip Victoria Corey. This name happened to be all Tiny's idea, giving Vicky little to no option but to accept the name that Vicky thought sounded like yet another of Tiny's publicity stunts, as Vicky claims that Tiny refused to sign the paperwork until she gave in and agreed to the name Tulip. Instead, Miss Vicky would always refer to Tulip as Victoria. Once they left the hospital and spent the night in a hotel room with their newborn, Vicky laid down the law and demanded that they purchase their own house to raise their child in, as she rightly claimed that hotels were no place to raise a baby. So, reluctantly, Tiny Tim agreed to move his family back to Brooklyn in New York. However, Tiny wasn't too happy about returning. Despite the house they moved into having 7 rooms and 2 bathrooms, there was little to no furniture. Vicky still wasn't happy and started losing her patience with Tiny, as Vicky claimed that Tiny slept in the master bedroom and she chose to sleep in a separate room, often sleeping beside Tulip. Making matters much worse was Tiny Tim was let go of by Reprise Records, who chose not to renew his contract, and he also started to notice that he could walk down the street unbothered as people started to move on from the former star. What made him sad most of all, however, was the fact that he wouldn't ever be able to afford to buy his mother a new home and get her out of New York with his career going down the drain. He attempted to stay relevant, even hosting a teenage beauty pageant, however, nothing was gaining traction anymore. Instead, Tiny turned his focus towards starting his very own independent music label called Victim Records, just like the name that tasteless journalist had suggested for his daughter's name. Under his own record label, Victim, Tiny would record and release a range of standalone singles in the style of country music, including one he wrote himself called Hendrix Joplin Morrison, Why Did They Have to Die So Young, with a B-side of Letter Edged in Black. This was followed by another original titled The Ballad of Attica Prison, with a B-side of Prisoner's Song, and then some Christmas carols were released with Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, with a B-side of White Christmas, all of which were released during 1971. Tiny would sign just one other singer to his Victim label in its existence, with country singer Tony Lee, who would put out just 2 unsuccessful songs. Desperately needing the work to support his wife and child, Tiny took up an offer from theatrical producer Roy Radin to work on his vaudeville review show, with Roy Radin said to have had links to the mob and boasted of being a millionaire. However, despite his new gig, Tiny was losing so much appeal that he appeared for the last time on The Tonight Show and on Laugh-In. Meanwhile, Tiny's marriage with Miss Vicky began to severely erode when she grew tired of their living conditions, always stuck on the road and in hotel rooms with their newborn. It wasn't what she envisioned for her family, and Tiny was calling all the shots, as Vicky said, quote, "I envisioned in my head a home with hardwood floors and matching dishes, children, cooking dinner every night, and that never came to be. I never cooked one dinner ever for him. Our life was on the road, in hotels, and that's what he wanted, and that's what he liked. Meanwhile, their financial situation was also putting a strain on their relationship, with Tiny, by 1972, estimated to be in debt by $20,000, caused partly by over-tipping people excessively, allowing his entourage to basically rip him off. He would gamble, spend on makeup, and he would also have food binges, racking up huge bills. Tiny also liked to keep Vicky isolated and to himself, displaying his strong narcissistic tendencies in relationships, as when he was away on tour, he forbid her from having any guests over, including her own sister, Tracy. However, Vicky was also said to have had a nasty side, as Miss Sue claimed that Tiny told her that Vicky would often hit him physically. While Tiny's old-school fundamentalist beliefs started to rub Vicky up the wrong way, with Tiny often stating things like, "A woman's place is in the kitchen," or, quote, "behind the stove," while he wouldn't even clean the house, leaving this solely to Vicky. When Tiny discovered that Vicky had been using contraceptives, such as the pill, Tiny went into a rage, claiming that he felt betrayed, as he strongly believed in all life being sacred, and was firmly against abortion and contraception, such as condoms and the pill. In reality, Vicky wasn't attracted to Tiny anymore, and the last thing she wanted to do was give him another child, stating, quote, "I didn't want any more babies because I knew a drunken monkey with a loaded pistol would be a better parent than he'd ever be," while Vicky also claimed that she felt second to Tiny Tim's career. It was also around this time that Miss Vicky was alleged to have begun an affair with a male model named John Carmen after the pair had met on set while Tiny was shooting a TV appearance. Rumours would then circulate that Vicky was seen out at nightclubs with John, however, Tiny would be last to know about the affair. Tiny would later admit on the Downey reboot show that he did hit Miss Vicky once when he discovered that she had been unfaithful to him, as he tried to justify his actions. On February 22nd, 1972, while Tiny was away on tour, Vicky would leave Tiny and went to stay at her parents' house in Haddonfield, New Jersey, taking with her some possessions and baby Tulip, of course, before leaving Tiny with a note telling him it was over. When Tiny arrived home to find the letter, he would chastise Vicky's parents by sending countless telegrams informing them on how nasty and horrible Vicky was as a person, but they would only be left disappointed in Tiny as they previously thought a lot of him. Tiny would be first to go to the media, stating to the New York Times, quote, "This thing kills me to the bone." Meanwhile, the media began to run their own gossip columns on what they thought had happened, claiming that Vicky only married Tiny for fame, that there was another man in the picture, or that Vicky's aspiration to become a model clashed with Tiny's ideals. When Vicky sought out an official divorce from Tiny, he would refuse, claiming that once they were married, they would always be, no matter what happens, until death, and that he didn't believe in divorce. Tiny claimed that he would keep their wedding ring on his finger and that he held hope that one day she would come to her senses and return to be with him. However, it would be under his conditions only, including that she must have a venereal disease test and quit modelling. Vicky, on the other hand, claimed that Tiny didn't want the divorce as it would make him look weak to the public. Despite this, Vicky claimed that he had his moments where he was a good husband, saying he was kind and caring. As Tiny said about Miss Vicky at the time, that quote, "I told Miss Vicky exactly the way it was, that I didn't believe in birth control, or in rhythm, or in sex, except for blessed events, meaning marriage. I didn't want to put a burden on her. She didn't have to marry me. I was very difficult to live with. I got down on my knees and prayed, 'If you want fame or glory, you don't have to go down the aisle with me. But if you do, this is exactly the way it's going to be.'" Despite all of this, and their marriage seeming like it was over, Vicky would agree to return to Tiny, placing their divorce on hold and giving him a second chance. As time went on, the divorce proceedings stalled, and as Tiny and Vicky sorted through their messy marriage, Tiny put out his final two singles on Victim Records, including covers of Maggie May by Rod Stewart and Delilah by Tom Jones. While Skepta Records would release Tiny's next single during 1972, called Am I Just Another Pretty Face? However, none of these singles would come anywhere near his previous success. In 1973, Tiny retired the Victim Records label and started up a second one called Toilet Records. As Tiny claimed, he called it this as his career was in the toilet. Under Toilet Records, he put out a single called I Ain't Got No Money. Tiny would also produce this single, but due to clashing contract obligations to a company called Brightstar, he would appear as the producer on the record as the alias called Ophelia Pratt. Around this time, Tiny would befriend a man who was a woman's activist of all people, named Isidore Fertel, who became Tiny's protege, signing Isidore as his first and last signing to Toilet Records, and releasing a cover of I Am Woman. The single failed to make an impact, and the record label Toilet Records would be dissolved. However, Tiny continued to hang out with the strange Isidore Fertel, who Vicky became frustrated by, as they would sing all night long and keep her and the baby awake. Fertel was described by Vicky as someone who was just as strange as Tiny, while Fertel often expressed he was a woman or that he wanted to become a woman well before transgender became a possibility. Tiny and Fertel would start clashing, however, over Tiny's strong old-school views against women's rights and role in the world, with Fertel actually approaching Vicky and telling her that she would be wise to leave Tiny. Tiny would continue to release singles and collaborations with other artists, and even travelled to Guam, the Philippines, and Tasmania in Australia to perform at naval bases for the troops. Sadly, Tiny and Vicky's relationship would only become more toxic and physical when Tiny punched Vicky in the head after she refused to attend an event at the Lincoln Center with him. However, Vicky once again decided to stay with Tiny, only this time stating that she would leave or call her mother if he ever did it again. The incident left Vicky shaken and confused, however, as she claimed, how could someone who claims to be a good Christian and faithful to Jesus and God be so hypocritical? As she explained, that he would reinterpret anything to, quote, do whatever he wanted to do. Making matters worse were Tiny's managers Jim and Joe Cappy's dislike for Vicky, with Vicky sensing that they were out to split the pair up. As they continued on their tour, this led them to their horror trip of England, where chaos ensued at every turn. Tiny was left fuming on the trip when he discovered that Vicky was catching feelings for their tour guide, named Amos Levy, after Tiny's manager, Jim Cappy, discovered that Vicky had slipped Amos a note expressing that she had feelings for him. However, Vicky denied this when confronted. When Tiny raised this to Vicky, she was believed to have expressed that she wanted to kill herself, with Tiny being quite heartless and calling her bluff, by ordering her a set of steak knives to be delivered to their hotel room, daring her to go through with her threat. Luckily, Vicky didn't go through with this, however the tour continued on as if nothing ever happened. But just days later, a sleepy Amos Levy was driving Tiny's tour bus when he started drifting off to sleep. Concerned, Jim Cappy would take over the driving, however, he was having difficulty with driving on the opposite side of the road to what he was used to in the USA. Cappy would overturn on a sharp bend, causing the bus to roll. The injuries were quite serious, causing Joe Cappy and Vicky to return home to the States with broken collarbones. Vicky recovered so quickly, however, that she was able to return to the tour of England for the last week alongside Jim Cappy, who stepped in for his injured brother Joe, with Jim only tagging along to keep an eye on Vicky, claiming that she was there to cheat on Tiny with their tour guide, Amos Levy. Vicky was furious upon hearing of this, and abused Joe Cappy over the phone about his persistence to break the couple up, and Vicky assumed that they had it in for her, and felt alone when Tiny failed to stick up for her. Joe Cappy would get his wish, however, when Tiny travelled to Australia to tour, with Joe Cappy making a return from injury, and choosing to leave Vicky at home, with Tiny choosing his career over his wife. Tiny's distrust for Vicky was so extreme, however, that he sent her home from England without keys to their house, hoping she couldn't get up to no good and cheat on him while he wasn't there, only for Vicky to inform him that she had a spare set of keys anyway. This angered Tiny, who sent one of the Cappy brothers around to change the locks on the house. However, Vicky was already home. The toxic relationship had reached an unhealthy climax, and it was time the two went their separate ways, as both parties were being unfaithful to each other. This would well and truly spell the end of Tiny and Vicky's marriage, as Vicky was worn out by Tiny's lack of trust and disrespect for her. When Tiny arrived home from New Zealand, after failing to sell many tickets, Vicky sat down with Tiny and informed him it was over, before finally leaving with 2-year-old Tulip. Tiny wouldn't exactly go easy, however, refusing to give Vicky anything from their apartment they had together, including the baby's crib. Early 1974 would prove tough for Tiny, with no Vicky, Tulip, or gigs being booked for 4 months, as he spent much of his time wallowing in his sorrows, watching mind-numbing TV, binging on food, and calling his mother. Tiny's debt had also now grown to over $30,000, and he was essentially broke and with no offers for gigs coming in other than one from Roy Raiden. He reluctantly chose to go with Raiden, signing a contract with him to become his manager for a period of 7 years at 20% of Tiny's earnings, which meant Raiden would join Tiny's long list of contracts with other managers like the Cappies. Raiden's big idea was to repackage Tiny with a makeover. However, other than changing his shopping bag and telling Tiny to wear suits instead, not much really changed, while Tiny's new show included a backing band which became known as Tiny Tim and the Timmies. Initially, they struggled to gel together, with Justin Martell claiming they struggled to adapt to Tiny's style and that Tiny was quite rude to them, often snapping at them during rehearsals. As time went on, Tiny began to have trust in them and the chemistry grew. Tiny himself, however, wasn't happy with the so-called new Tiny Tim, as it wasn't his own idea and he hated being moulded by someone else, on what they thought would sell. The Timmies found Tiny to be a strange man, and on one evening, members of the Timmies overheard Tiny and a woman yelling in the middle of the night and throwing things around his hotel room. Concerned about what could be going on, they rushed to tell Tiny's manager, only for him to claim it was best to leave Tiny alone and that he wasn't with a woman, and that Tiny likes to argue with himself and changes voices or characters. This raised questions to many at the time if Tiny's spiralling personal life and career was having a negative impact on his mental health, as another of his managers, according to Harry Stein, claimed that Tiny on one occasion, late at night, came into Tiny's room after hearing Tiny talking, only to walk into a pitch black room as he noticed Tiny was moving from chair to chair, pretending to have a dinner party with other guests. Not to mention, Tiny had increasingly put on weight as he began to drink beer regularly and continued to order excessive amounts of room service of mostly comfort foods like pancakes, spaghetti bolognese, and pizza. Tiny also discovered a strange way to abstain from masturbating or from sexual thoughts, as he would keep images of human disfigurements and venereal diseases inside his Bible to look at whenever he became aroused to stop himself from sinning. After Tiny toured briefly with the Timmies, also joining his band were his two backup singers called the Tulips. However, this didn't seem to brighten his spirits any further, as he began to spiral out of control on stage, often drinking a number of beers before going on, and at times stripping his jacket and pants off before rolling around on the floor as if he was having some sort of epileptic fit, often with his beer belly hanging out of his shirt. Then, in an appearance on the Mike Douglas show, Tiny enraged viewers and the women's liberation movement when he pulled out his Bible and declared on national TV, quote, "It says right here, man is over woman." Around this time, Tiny started being more outspoken about a woman's place in the home, while his unsavory personal life started to leak to the public. Tiny would next make an appearance on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show for the first time in 3 years, during November 1974, attempting to promote his so-called new act. When Carson questioned him on the status of his career and personal life after his split from Miss Vicky, he couldn't help himself as he went on a tirade displaying to the nation his controlling and narcissistic ways, as he said, quote, "I don't believe in divorce. If she comes back 20 years from now, fine, under my terms, of course," before claiming if she ever comes back, he would put blocks on her family's phone numbers so she can't call them, and she would need to take a blood test to check if she had any venereal diseases. Meanwhile, these questions put to Tiny Tim about Miss Vicky began to raise the question of where is she? As the media began leaking and running stories that Vicky and their daughter Tulip were living off of welfare since August 1974, in London, England, leaving Vicky no choice but to also work as a pole dancer and a go-go dancer, and that Tiny had stopped paying child support. Tiny's manager, Joe Cappy, would come out claiming Tiny was still paying $100 in child support every week, despite not even seeing Tulip since January 1974, and that they doubted that Vicky had been on welfare. However, no one actually knew where Vicky was, and she wasn't coming forward to reply to these claims. With Vicky's own mother confirming that she hadn't been home in weeks and that she had moved to England. Meanwhile, Tiny would receive an eviction notice for Tiny and Vicky's apartment in New Jersey that they had been renting, with Tiny essentially left homeless. At this same time, Miss Vicky would be under investigation by welfare for potential fraud if it could be proven that she had been taking welfare while working at the same time. While on the road with the Timmies and the Tulips, Tiny's unlucky streak continued when their tour bus almost had a head-on collision with a truck, causing them to swerve into a snowbank. At one of the shows, Tiny tripped over the drum set and smashed his trusty ukulele. There was a bomb threat at a show in Illinois, and while at another small show, with no dressing room, Tiny was forced to get changed behind a temporary barrier, only for it to topple over, revealing Tiny's body to the entire crowd, as he was in the middle of changing into his outfit, sending the crowd into hysterics and embarrassing Tiny. Tiny would next appear on the Phil Donahue show, where once again, Tiny was very vocal on his opinions about women and their roles in society, causing the live audience to begin biting back at him as an argument between Tiny and the female audience members ensued. The more and more Tiny began voicing these opinions, the more the general public began to turn away from him, making him far less likable and worth getting on talk shows, as it simply was a bad look with the changing times. By March 1975, Tiny Tim's band, the Timmies, had all decided to quit, claiming they'd had enough due to poor pay and rumours that Roy Raiden was linked to the mob and shady people. Tiny Tim himself also wanted out, craving the freedom to run his own career, but decided to stay on with Raiden for the time being, as a new cast of musicians were hand-selected for the Timmies band. Just a month later, during April 1975, in Pennsylvania, after just a couple of shows with his new band members, Tiny, the Timmies, the Tulips, and Jim Cappy, who was driving the bus, were involved in yet another serious accident when a car driving out of control veered onto the off-ramp onto the wrong side of the road, jumping the divider at speed, swerving vehicles in its path, only to plough head-on into Tiny's tour bus. Tiny luckily was seated at the back of the bus, however he sustained serious injuries, suffering a punctured lung, torn ligaments in his ankles, as well as 8 broken ribs. While Jim Cappy luckily walked away with just a collapsed rib cage. Sadly, however, it was determined that the driver of the other car, named Paul Krupp, had suffered from a heart attack, causing him to drive so erratically and costing him his life. While his wife in the passenger seat sustained serious injuries but survived. Tiny was left shaken by the incident and would receive a number of Get Well Soon cards from worried fans and calls from his mother Tilly while recovering for 3 months at Joe Cappy's house. The new Tiny Tim show, featuring the Timmies and the Tulips, was well and truly buried from this accident, with Tiny choosing not to revamp the act. While at least 7 court cases were stacked against Tiny at this time, mostly due to Tiny not fulfilling the countless contracts he had signed over the years, however, there was hardly any money to Tiny's name, leaving some such as George King to drop the case after previously seeking $1.5 million in damages, after he claimed that Tiny's inability to meet these contractual obligations left him no choice but to enter the world of male prostitution. In August 1975, Vicky had been tracked down finally for an interview after she had moved back to New Jersey with the now 4-year-old Tulip to work at Minnie's Lounge, which was yet another adult dance club. Vicky confirmed in these interviews that she was working as a go-go dancer and as a model, but that she did not accept welfare at the same time, only when she couldn't work due to problems with her kidneys, and that she paid for her relocation to London after selling her wedding ring, as she knew there was no chance of them ever getting back together, despite still loving him from afar. While Vicky also claimed that Tiny hadn't been keeping up with regular child support payments, despite his claims of paying $100 regularly, and was quoted as saying, "I don't think he should have to pay for a mistake that I made." It was also around this time that Vicky started gaining her voice back and chose to sell her story to the UK's Sunday Mirror for a total of $50,000, which was actually titled "My Insufferable Marriage to Tiny Tim," with Vicky delivering a scathing report of their relationship, making all sorts of claims, such as the fact that she married Tiny because he was famous, that they slept in separate bedrooms, that Tiny was only interested in men, that he wanted to become a woman, that he failed to last longer than 2 seconds in the bedroom at times, or that no matter what she did, she couldn't get him aroused. While also confirming one of Tiny's earlier fears, which was that Vicky had met up again with Amos Levy when she moved back to London, only for the fling to turn sour when Levy started being creepy and essentially stalked her. When Vicky discovered that Amos Levy had an outstanding criminal history and that he was wanted by police, Vicky decided it would be safer to move back home with her daughter to New Jersey, where she could be close to her parents and her family. Vicky claimed that she later received letters from Levy from inside a jail cell after he was caught by police. While Vicky also claimed about Tiny Tim, quote, "I don't think he had the capacity to love." Tiny would in some way respond in an interview, claiming that Vicky cheated on him before their marriage, that he was only aggressive once towards her due to her cheating, and he didn't want to get a divorce as he didn't believe in it, claiming that she would always really be his wife and nothing could change that. Shocking Tiny and the rest of the world during October 1975 would be Vicky's debut in the pornographic industry for Wee magazine, where Vicky could be seen bearing all as she revealed that she earned around £4,000 for the shoot. This would spark outrage for Tiny, as he claimed in Harry Stein's biography of him that Vicky must have been drinking heavily or taking drugs due to these nude photos, or that she had been cursed by the devil and turned away from God. With these raunchy photos leading Tiny to take Vicky to court in a custody battle over their daughter Tulip, with Tiny claiming that Vicky was mentally unstable and morally and emotionally unable to care for their daughter. However, with little substantial evidence, Tiny's claims went nowhere and were thrown out of court. Tiny would sadly have little to do with Tulip growing up, and to be fair, he didn't seem to want to, instead taking Vicky to court over custody as a way to get back at her, using their child as a pawn. However, Vicky claimed that they didn't hold it against him, and that it was common in those days for the father not to be around, with Tulip later claiming that her memory of her father was, quote, vague, and that she didn't spend much time with him, only receiving the odd phone call from him now and then. Tulip claimed that he seemed nice enough, however it was hard to look past the negative portrayal that her mother Vicky had painted or filled her head with, as Vicky wouldn't speak very highly of Tiny in front of her. As she said on Tiny Tim King for a Day, quote, "I don't think that I'm proud," as she went on to say that the negative stories are, quote, "stuck in my mind. Maybe at times I felt embarrassed, but now that I'm older, I realize everyone's different, and he was different for his era." With Tiny in damage control against the media, his ex-wife, and from his dwindling reputation, and after his failed comeback with the Timmies, he was informed by the Cappies that he could no longer afford the luxury of staying or living in hotel rooms, forcing his hand to move back in with his disappointed elderly mother Tilly in Washington Heights, Manhattan, at the sorry age of 43. Tiny Tim had well and truly hit rock bottom, as Tiny said around this time in his diaries, quote, "I often felt depressed. I didn't care if I lived or died, and I felt dying was the better option." With Tiny Tim down in the dumps, that never-say-die attitude within him would once again raise its head when Tiny got his second wind and started to plan yet another comeback. Just 13 days after moving back in with his mother Tilly, she gave him some money so he could move out once again, as he returned to staying in hotels, as Tiny, at the same time, was hit with divorce papers from Vicky. However, Tiny refused to sign them and even hired a lawyer to fight the divorce.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Hi everyone, and sorry to interrupt. I hope you're enjoying this episode, but I just wanted to take this opportunity to tell you four ways on how you can support the podcast and play your part in keeping it going so I can continue to bring you more great episodes. If you enjoy Lyrics of Their Life podcast, first of all, it would be greatly appreciated if you could subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. It's totally free to do. It just means that you will receive a notification when a new episode of the podcast becomes available. Secondly, you can leave the podcast a positive 5-star review on iTunes, as this helps the podcast reach a larger audience. Third of all, you can tell your friends all about the podcast or join us on our social media pages at Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. While finally, you can take your support one step further and head to our Patreon page and pledge your support to one of two of our plans for just $1 or $5 per month with no lock-in contract. Or you can pledge just a one-off payment for all the hard work that goes into creating the podcast, and you will receive a number of extra benefits to go with your donation. Or you can even buy me a beer for $5 at buymeacoffee.com/lyricsoflifepod. I am a totally independent podcast creator, meaning there are no large networks or businesses financially supporting my work, so your support would be greatly appreciated, as it means I can continue creating more content, such as biographies, the weekly muse, interviews, and more, as it takes a lot of time, resources, and research to prepare and upload just one single episode. Links to Patreon and Buy Me a Coffee can be found in the show notes on our website at lyricsoftheirlife.com or on our Facebook page. Once again, I appreciate every one of my listeners for their support, no matter the form it comes in. Thanks for listening. Now let's get back to the episode.
The remainder of 1975 would prove challenging for Tiny, with him struggling to land gigs or simply having them cancelled on him. However, in early 1976, Tiny toured quite extensively and released a single called Howard Cosell, We Think You're Swell. However, it wasn't to be successful. Meanwhile, Harry Stein would release Tiny Tim, an unauthorized biography, as the underrated book would struggle to sell at the time, despite now becoming a rare but great read. Tiny would also appear in an awkward interview on the Dick Cavett Show during 1976, as Tiny spoke about his cringy and inappropriate award system and the trophies he hands out to beautiful young women, as he says, quote, "Well, I'm very fortunate to meet so many beautiful young angels. Ever since 1963, I've been giving out trophies. I've given out 13 trophies since that year. Everything is in purity and no strings attached. I usually talk to them about their problems. We don't believe in any kissing or anything until marriage." The interview, however, would turn out to be a train wreck, and the host and another guest on the program were quite rude to him. It was around this time that Tiny also made an odd appearance on Al Goldstein's Midnight Blue, where Tiny, being the uncensored, open book that he often was, ventured into his sexual practices and even the topic of masturbation, shocking the audience at home. As Tiny told Al Goldstein that when engaging in oral sex with a woman, that he would cover her privates in honey and peanut butter to enjoy the taste better, as he didn't like the taste otherwise. While Tiny also revealed to Al that he would set a 3-hour timer to pleasure the woman first, and only after the 3-hour mark would he be allowed to climax himself. However, he said he didn't care much for climaxing himself, as he said, quote, "I've always told them I don't want you to touch me when the night first began. I don't want you to touch me. I don't want you to disturb me, because I don't want to release myself. Because I'm only here to give you pleasure for at least 3 hours. Because once I was released, I'd be as weak as water." During 1977, Tiny would release a further 2 singles, including a rebranding of Tiptoe Through the Tulips, called Tiptoe Disco. However, it was unsuccessful, as many found it to be a novelty cash grab. While Tiny also ventured into the country music scene with a song about a struggling country singer who undergoes a dramatic change to his act by becoming a drag queen, with the song being titled, "I'm Going to Be a Country Queen." This track, yet again, was a commercial flop. For many years now, Tiny over the phone had told Vicky that he wished to see Tulip and that they should arrange to meet up. However, when Vicky actually agreed, he failed to follow through, except on one occasion when he showed up unannounced, only for Tulip to be fast asleep at the ridiculous hour of 3 a.m. Tiny asked Vicky if she could wake her up so he could see her, but she rejected his offer, as Tulip had school the following morning, with Tiny agreeing it would be unwise, so he left. During March 1977, over 3 years after their separation, Tiny would finally venture to New Jersey in person to see Tulip, with Miss Vicky bringing their now 5-year-old daughter along and paying for Tiny's cab to come and see his daughter. With Tiny claiming that during this reunion, he and Vicky found the time to make love and vowed to stay in touch. However, Vicky had other ideas, and during the meeting, Vicky used it as a chance to bring up the divorce that she had now been seeking for over 2 years. Tiny would have no choice, however, when the divorce application reached the state's expiration date and Vicky proved they had not been living together and didn't intend on getting back together, as the state of New Jersey awarded the divorce to Miss Vicky, finally freeing her of Tiny Tim by mid-1977, as she would go on to divorce and remarry a number of times, with her next marriage being to a mysterious man known as X Lombardi. Tiny, of course, was outraged, telling every media outlet under the sun that he didn't believe in divorce, while telling the Washington Post, "I'm married till death do us part. I believe marriage is a sacred institution. I cannot get married again." And he believed that if he did, he would be living in sin. While all of this was going on, Tiny had a stalker problem. A young woman named Miss Jan, who was once a 15-year-old watching on in the live audience as Vicky and Tiny tied the knot, she wasn't going away and verged on stalking Tiny, even if he didn't mind so much. As she popped up at a show in California, swooning over Tiny to the point that she fainted. While Tiny occasionally entertained the idea of flirting with Miss Jan, he would ask his agent to tell her to back off, as he didn't want to succumb to sin, as the now 20-year-old Miss Jan wouldn't take no for an answer, showing up at Tiny's show at the Copacabana in August 1977, where Tiny couldn't resist any longer, and for the first time in his life, he had sexual intercourse outside of marriage, with Tiny afterwards feeling extremely guilty and as though he had sinned. However, it was almost as though Tiny liked tempting his faith and sinning when he slept with Miss Jan again before breaking it off, before sleeping with another woman called Miss Popcorn, followed by watching a porn film at an adult movie cinema dressed in a hooded jumper to hide his appearance. Tiny would also receive a handjob from a prostitute, literally phoning a friend in Half Man to lend him some money for the sexual act, as all the hard work he had done resisting temptation was fading away. Tiny was now nothing but a hypocrite and gave in to his sexual temptations. He even raised the possibility of starring in a porn film himself, where he could be seen singing over the top as part of the soundtrack to the film. Tiny would reunite with Roy Radin and his vaudeville review, performing with them from mid-1978 through to 1979, billed under the name The King of Nostalgia. However, it wouldn't take him back to the big time like he had hoped, and Roy Radin's cocaine addiction started to affect the success of the show. Instead, Tiny would go on tour and head down under to Australia for a number of months, where he would link up with an Australian artist and entrepreneur named Martin Sharp. Martin Sharp was 10 years younger than Tiny and was well known in Australia for his cartoon-style drawings and paintings, and was renowned as Australia's most prominent pop artist, designing posters for various circuses and even helping to write the Cream song, Tales of Brave Ulysses, which was actually originally a poem. While Martin Sharp also designed the artwork for two of Cream's album covers, Martin Sharp would invest a lot of time and money into Tiny, adoring his act from afar for many years, as he had hoped to help Tiny get back to the top after first seeing Tiny perform during 1968 at the Royal Albert Hall, after former Cream member Eric Clapton had recommended he do so, as he too was a big fan. Martin Sharp would also become a fan after that performance, racing home to play Clapton's copy of God Bless Tiny Tim, stating, quote, "It changed my life that night," while he also said, "Tim's appropriation of song is very much like my appropriation of images. We are both collagists, taking the elements of different epochs and mixing them to discover new relationships." Martin Sharp had actually been bringing Tiny out to Australia since 1976 and would travel around with Tiny on tour, recording him as they go, beginning with a performance in Newcastle, New South Wales. Sharp was enamoured with Tiny and couldn't understand why he had lost so much popularity, as he said, quote, "I thought a world that is not appreciative of Tiny Tim is not a world I admire." As Sharp continued to bring Tiny to Australia several more times and even painted his portrait, he would even label Tiny the, quote, "eternal troubadour" or the human lyrebird. During the early 70s, Martin Sharp had become heavily involved in the theme park Luna Park in Sydney, Australia, which had been opened back in 1935, with Sharp falling in love with the place that boasted the catchphrase, "just for fun." Sharp, like many, was keen to keep the park up and running by helping to restore the park with his artistic vision and through fundraisers and awareness, as he and fellow artist Peter Kingston applied their pop art cartoon styles to various attractions around the park, with Sharp himself, back in 1973, repainting the large famous smiling mask seen at the park's entrance and replacing it with a clown face with a different expression. Talks continued over the years about the park potentially coming under new owners or being redeveloped into high-rises or apartment buildings. However, Martin Sharp, among others, stood firm and protested these proposals, as he said, quote, "It took us a while to realise that Luna Park was an artwork in itself, a city-state of illusion, a brilliant feat of engineering with imagination, created and maintained by men. Sydney must acknowledge the importance of Luna Park. To lose it now would be a tragedy." During late 1978, Tiny Tim and Martin Sharp thought up an idea to set the world record for the longest non-stop professional singing marathon, where Tiny would perform a medley of songs, which attracted quite a large media following at the time, which would only help the park survive. On the 12th of January 1979, Tiny would appear at Luna Park Sydney for what Martin Sharp called it the world professional non-stop singing record, which would take place in front of a live crowd on the floating pontoon stage at the Palais du Dance. Tiny made his way across via boat to the pontoon stage to begin his performance, as Martin Sharp introduced Tiny and said, quote, "Would you welcome to the stage America's ambassador of song, the eternal troubadour, the human lyrebird, the Superman of song, Mr. Tiny Tim?" Initially expecting just to last 2 hours, Tiny successfully set the world record, performing for 2 hours, 20 minutes and 40 seconds, performing a total of 139 songs in that time. The crowd and even the media absolutely loved the performance, and Tiny was ecstatic to break the record. Tiny even found the energy to perform a couple more songs as an encore to the patient fans who had sat with him the whole time, as he sunk to the ground, ripping his shirt off and kicking about on the ground while singing an Elvis number. Sadly though, despite clearly breaking the record, the Guinness World Records would never officially recognise it. Meanwhile, that same month, during January 1979, Tiny got to work on 2 albums which would be produced by Martin Sharp himself, titled Chameleon and Wonderful World of Romance. The more commercially friendly Chameleon album would fare slightly the better of the two, including covers like The Great Pretender, My Way, It's a Long Way to Tipperary, and the Bee Gees, Staying Alive. However, only 600 copies were pressed between the 2 albums, which were both released in 1980 under Martin Sharp's self-funded label, Street of Dreams Records. While capturing Tiny's adventures on camera while in Australia, Martin Sharp set off to produce a documentary on Tiny's life and career, including interviews and footage captured with Tiny's mother while also performing across Australia. However, Sharp's plans for releasing the documentary were stalled when, just months after Tiny's historic performance at Luna Park, tragedy would strike, shocking the entire country of Australia. When on the 9th of June 1979, at 10:15 at night, 7 people were killed on the popular ghost train ride at Luna Park in Sydney, as the ghost train had sadly caught fire. 35 people were on the ride at the time, with only 28 of them emerging from the thick black smoke billowing out from the large ride doors, with the victims sadly including 4 best mates from Waverley College in the eastern suburbs, including 13-year-old Richard Carroll and 12-year-olds Jonathan Billings, Michael Johnson and Seamus Raheely, while a man named John Godson and his 2 young sons named Damien and Craig also tragically lost their lives in the fire. As the carts were horrifically sent directly into the burning inferno, trapping them inside, where they tragically perished. Miraculously, Jennifer Godson, the mother and wife to the Godson victims, escaped certain death after a sudden and unusual craving for ice cream led her to skip that fateful ride with her family, while the 12-year-old maid of the four boys that perished in the fire, named Jason Holman, also had a lucky escape after he was told to wait for the next ride, as the ride was full up. The park would be closed immediately after the horrible incident, and a federal investigation was conducted. However, they lacked sufficient evidence to draw conclusions, instead putting it down to a likely electrical fault, despite having insufficient evidence on what or where the fault actually started from. The entire ghost train ride burnt down that night due to a lack of firefighting equipment and insufficient staffing. However, many theories surrounding the fire would circulate, as there were simply far too many loose ends and strange coincidences, with witnesses on the ride during and before the fire claiming that they noticed the fake fireplace within the ride looked as though it was really on fire, despite there being no way that the fake fireplace could actually cause a fire unless something was purposely lit and thrown in there. One of these theories included Martin Sharp's belief that an arsonist, organized by a powerful broker interested in purchasing the site and repurposing the park into apartments, sent someone in to set the ride on fire intentionally. As Martin Sharp, like many, believed that it was targeted, as it was set to go under redevelopment and put up for sale soon, while many of the investigation practices and police actions were said to have been suspect and potentially corrupt, as Sharp answered that he was, quote, sure of it that an arsonist was to blame here. Other theories went as far as to suggest it was carried out as arson by underworld figure Abe Saffron, while some say it was even the work of a demon, who was allegedly spotted before the event occurred, along with signage that read Hell's Doorway, as carts entered the ride, with Martin Sharp stating that after the fire, it changed his whole spiritual outlook on life. The Luna Park ghost train remains an unsolved mystery to this day, and a popular story among Australians. If you are interested in the ghost train fire story, I highly recommend watching the ABC's Exposed: The Ghost Train Fire, as the case has recently been reopened to look into some of the claims suggested by Martin Sharp, among others. After the tragic event, Martin Sharp grew increasingly suspect on the New South Wales government, who took control of the park after the incident, and as he and artist Peter Kingston were concerned on what they would do with the site, they started the Friends of Luna Park organisation to raise awareness and support to keep the park as the historic site it was, and maintain that it stays a theme park. Martin Sharp would put together an unfinished documentary called Street of Dreams, compiling video from Tiny Tim, Luna Park, The Ghost Train Fire, and Tiny Tim's record-breaking medley, linking them together in his weird and wacky way to suggest that all these things were connected in some way, with Sharp claiming that one of the reasons for Tiny's connection to the fire was that there was a full moon on the night of Tiny's performance, and six full moons later, there was one on the night of the fire, which also happened to be 6 months apart. Despite Tiny, of course, being back home in the US at the time. The unfinished project of Sharp's would struggle to be released after failing to get financial backing, with many claiming it would be far too controversial. However, it did make it to film festivals much later in 1988 as a rough cut. Sharp would work on the project throughout his life, even putting his own fortune into funding the project, as well as supporting Luna Park, all the way up until his death in December 2013, at the age of 71, where he claimed that the project still wasn't complete yet. Tiny and Martin Sharp continued their strong friendship and collaboration, with Martin Sharp making quirky but outstanding suits for Tiny to wear, with one even including the sheet music to the Australian song Waltzing Matilda, and others including comic strips. And while here in Australia, Tiny was even said to have fallen for a woman from Brisbane, Australia, named Miss Natasha, who was quite possibly a transvestite, as Tiny, onwards from his Luna Park appearance, felt tempted by women everywhere as he attempted to control himself and refrain from sinning. With Tiny returning to the USA, he would release a minor hit and remake titled Tiptoe to the Gas Pumps, due to the current soaring price of petrol in the United States. This was followed by the release of Do You Think I'm Sexy, as a cover version of Rod Stewart's hit song, in what was almost a parody version. Whether or not it was supposed to be funny, Tiny even released a video clip for the song as he appears rubbing his overweight body as he dances with a bunch of women on a tennis court. Sadly, the video was cringy and people were now laughing at him rather than laughing along with him. To promote the two songs, Tiny would also appear on the Johnny Carson show for the final time during 1979, as the now overweight Tiny Tim sang Tiptoe to the Gas Pumps before sitting down to be interviewed by Carson, copping questions from him about his weight as the awkwardness was felt, as Tiny hadn't been invited back on the show in many years, almost being used and booted out when he was no longer at the height of his fame. While on the show, Tiny then started singing Do You Think I'm Sexy, beginning quite sensibly before upping the ante when he began to roll around on stage, stripping his Martin Sharp designed Flash Gordon suit off and throwing his tie and jacket into the crowd before revealing his hairy chest and bare white belly protruding from his white t-shirt that read, The Time Machine, Tiny Tim World Record, as Tiny's bum crack flashed the audience briefly before he screamed into the microphone, singing, If You Think I'm Sexy, Come On Sugar Let Me Know, as he fell to the floor and kicked about on his back on stage, almost out of control, before laying still exhausted from the performance, only to stand up and take a seat with Carson's guests, as if nothing ever happened, leaving Carson with a look of shock on his face, as he said, quote, There's just nothing to be said, as the live audience were in hysterics, cheering for the performance. Despite many at home turning their nose up to the performance, Tiny inspired one man in particular that would become known as Weird Al Yankovic from that very performance. After the show had finished, Johnny Carson spoke to the producers and was believed to have vowed to never allow him back on the program as long as he hosted the show. Following this, during 1980, Tiny and Miss Vicky set up an unlikely business model together, as the two would perform together briefly at a Glendale, New York nightclub, with Tiny singing and Vicky dancing, as Vicky said that it was, quote, strictly business, and that she only did it as she needed the money, with the pair not even talking to one another after the shows. Tiny would then release a song for Luna Park titled Wind in the Willows, with Martin Sharp producing the single during September 1980, however it was unsuccessful. Around this time, Tiny Tim would also make a decision to move his elderly 88-year-old mother Tilly out of her family home that she had resided in since 1942 and would move her into a one-bedroom apartment in the Olcott Hotel on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, situated across the road from the Dakota Hotel, where the one and only John Lennon and his wife Yoko Ono were staying. It was a strange decision from Tiny, although he was worried about her health and the fact that she was quite lonely, so Tiny would live with her at the Olcott. But the new move would prove challenging, as it was a cockroach-infested building and was quite run down, with Tiny going to the length of sleeping with the light on to deter the cockroaches from crawling all over them and their things. During early November, Tiny actually crossed paths with John Lennon outside of their apartment buildings, and while Tiny was eager to say hello, he didn't want to disturb him and his wife, so he decided to keep on walking. Just a month later after his encounter with John Lennon, on the 8th of December 1980, John Lennon was shot dead outside of the Dakota Hotel by Mark David Chapman, just over 5 hours after signing the book Double Fantasy for Chapman himself. Tiny was saddened by the passing of John Lennon, so he would write a poem for him that read, "Here lies John Lennon, in life sang many songs. He had his joy and sorrow, was oftentimes sad at heart. May his sleep here be peaceful, beneath God's clear blue skies. While passing, drop a flower where John Lennon lies." Following John Lennon's tragic passing, Tiny would release further unsuccessful singles in 1981, including Zoot Zoot Zoot, Here Comes Santa in His New Space Suit, Yummy Yummy Pizza, and Comic Strip Man, with Tiny for this song usually performing in a Superman outfit, with most of these singles being styled as disco tracks. During 1981, Tiny would also celebrate his daughter Tulip's 10th birthday, while his popularity in Asia bizarrely grew, where he toured South Korea, as the locals treated the 48-year-old like royalty and swarmed him wherever he went. During March 1981, Tiny would land a 5-week gig on the cruise ship SS Norway, where he would meet a 25-year-old woman known as Miss Dixie while at the disco club on board the ship. The pair immediately were drawn to one another, with Miss Dixie attending Tiny's performances, and once the show had wrapped up, they'd venture off together for drinks and to dance. The pair would leave the SS Norway together, with Tiny travelling to West Virginia with Dixie to meet her 5-year-old daughter and her father. Sadly, however, Dixie had lived a tough life and had recently lost her husband in a construction accident in Ohio just a couple of years ago in 1978. Her husband was one of 30 people killed in the accident where a construction tower collapsed and crushed them. Tiny and Dixie's relationship, while loving, was quite rocky, however, as Tiny refused to have sex before marriage and he had doubts over marrying again, as he took issue with the fact that Dixie had her tubes tied, meaning that she couldn't have any more children. While Dixie also had her concerns and didn't want to marry Tiny, as she didn't feel that he could financially support her and her daughter. With Tiny unable to support them financially, he instead awarded Miss Dixie with a trophy for the most beautiful girl in the world, and even wrote her a song titled Forever Miss Dixie, which was released later as a single during 1983 as part of Tiny Tim's 7th studio album called Keeping My Troubles to Myself under Martin Sharp's label Street of Dreams, with the album including 4 tracks in total and being released exclusively to Australia. As Tiny would perform Forever Miss Dixie at the iconic Sydney Opera House during 1982, in what was a memorable career highlight for Tiny, as the crowd erupted in applause at the end of the show and demanded more. Tiny claimed that Miss Dixie was, quote, divine, and Martin Sharp believed he truly did love her and respected her. However, Miss Dixie often felt that he wasn't being sincere, and that he just wanted to make her another Miss Vicky. Miss Dixie's concerns were somewhat clarified when during 1983, Tiny was invited onto the Australian late-night TV show with Don Lane, where Tiny was asked if he would like to marry Miss Dixie live on air. Miss Dixie, however, strongly disagreed and refused to go through with it. Tiny and Miss Dixie were then said to have clashed in fiery physical fights, and in one instance, Tiny was allegedly chased by Miss Dixie with a kitchen knife around the house and out through the front door before jumping into a bush to hide, while she was also rumoured to have slapped him across the face at times. Tiny, however, wasn't innocent himself and was said to have been more mentally abusive towards Dixie as her mental health rapidly declined over the course of their relationship. During 1983, Miss Dixie made the decision to leave the relationship to focus on her daughter, as a distraught Tiny went back to being a bachelor and performing with the Roy Raiden Review. On May 13, 1983, 33-year-old Roy Raiden, who had supplied Tiny with steady employment since 1971 as part of the Vaudeville Review, was savagely murdered in what became known as the Cotton Club case. Raiden was attempting to revitalize his own career, attempting to break out of his cocaine addiction and rise up as a movie mogul. On this day, Roy was on his way to a conference in California involving the film Cotton Club, where he was reported missing by his personal assistant as he failed to show up. A month after going missing, two civilians, including a beekeeper and a forest ranger, came across his remains located at the bottom of a dry creek bed in a canyon on the outskirts of the small town of Gorman, which was approximately 65 miles or 105 kilometers north of his intended destination of LA, California. Rumored to be associated with the mob, Roy Raiden was suggested to have had a target on his back and was found dead, having had dynamite placed in his mouth and lit, along with over 20 bullet wounds, mainly to the head. It would take 5 years for arrests to be made and 8 years for anyone to be sentenced for the murder of Roy Raiden, with Karen Greenberger and Robert Lowe sentenced to life without parole for second-degree murder and kidnapping, and former bodyguards for Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flint turned hitmen William Mensa and Alex Marty were convicted of first-degree murder, receiving life without parole, and were slapped with the possibility of the death penalty by a gas chamber after they were arrested after bragging about the murder during a game of poker. While admitting to carrying out the murder for financial gain, expecting to receive a payment, in gruesome details, Marty and Mensa chose to shoot Raiden in the head multiple times and utilized dynamite in order to make it more challenging for the police to identify Roy Raiden. Karen Greenberger was revealed as one of the main instigators and masterminds behind the murder, with claims that Raiden was last seen getting into a limousine with her. However, it was difficult to prove how much influence she had on the whole situation. Karen was involved with the Latin American underworld as a drug dealer, with aspirations to make it in the film industry, just like Raiden. Raiden and Greenberger met during 1982, where she introduced Roy to the Cotton Club's film producer and her partner at the time, Robert Evans, with the pair striking a deal to fund the film. Jealous and feeling left out of the deal, Karen Greenberger decided to take matters into her own hands, and the rest was history. The Cotton Club film was released later in 1984, but sadly flopped at the box office. while many of the musicians who previously worked for Raiden came out to criticise him and point out his cocaine addiction and his flaws, Tiny Tim was one of the only ones to come out and defend him, and was sad to learn of his death, standing by Roy's sister Kate throughout the years, with Tiny even making the wild claim that he once thought he saw Roy at one of his shows in Australia after his proposed death, just standing in the crowd as Tiny wondered to himself if he got away and his death was staged. Despite this sad news, Tiny was just about to receive some more positive news when he would meet a woman named Jan Alwees, who would quickly become his second wife. Thank you for tuning into that episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes, ranging from Kurt Cobain and Freddie Mercury to Prince, Tracy Chapman and Stevie Nicks, and up-and-comers like Youngblood, Tones and I, and The Kid Laroi. For more information regarding this episode, including weekly updates and more, head to our Facebook page at Lyrics of Their Life Podcast, or our website at lyricsoftheirlife.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and even YouTube and Spotify, where you can find a range of playlists featuring the music of every artist covered in the Lyrics of Their Life podcast so far. If you really enjoy the podcast and would like to give back for the hard work that goes into it, it would be greatly appreciated if you could leave a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, or you can now rate the podcast on Spotify. Don't forget to let your friends and family know about what they've been missing out on, and feel free to click the free subscribe or follow button to the podcast wherever you listen, so you can receive a notification every time a new episode becomes available. If you would like to support the podcast financially, then please feel free to head to Patreon or buymeacoffee.com, where you can contribute your support for the podcast in exchange for some bonus content, ranging from as little as $1 donations to really anything you like. Every bit of support is greatly appreciated, and it means I can continue to bring you more great episodes in the future. This podcast is created and researched completely independently, so your contribution would really help this podcast continue on. Once again, thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed that episode. I'm your host, Adam Hampton, and this is Lyrics of Their Life.